This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 7:11. You're listening to the Evening Edition with Lynn and Sharmila. And we are now turning our attention to the fact that 2 days ago, the DG of Health, Tan Sri Dr. Nur Hisham Abdullah, announced that the country's healthcare system is at a breaking point because of COVID-19. And therefore, we may consider a more targeted approach of the movement control order.
Yes. So, on that, yesterday, our daily numbers actually reached the highest we've ever had, reaching the 3,000 mark. Actually at 3,027 new cases yesterday. And today it's slightly lower, but still nevertheless pretty alarming still at 2,643. And this idea of another MCO being implemented, there are various things that are being talked about, including the idea of it being imposed specifically in Penang, Selangor, KL, Malacca, Johor and Sabah, because these are the states that have been reporting high daily infection rates.
So we should say that Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri Yaakob, the Minister of Defence, has shared that the Prime Minister will be announcing the government's plans to tackle COVID-19 next week on Monday. So there's definitely going to be more to talk about then. And we will know, I think, in hopefully a firmer fashion, what exactly is going to happen. But, you know, if we did go back into some form of lockdown, we would hardly be alone. The United Kingdom, of course, just went back into that. France has gone in and out. Germany went into a nationwide lockdown in December. That's now been extended till the end of this month. They've also previously imposed lockdowns on specific states. Let me just continue this litany of misery. Tokyo just declared a state of emergency. India has been in a full lockdown in April, has had several unlock phases since. And various states in Australia have also cycled through lockdowns, mostly, 6 weeks, 2 months in that area in 2020.
Which is to say that we are not alone, whatever little comfort that might be. But I think the question is actually whether we can afford to go back into a full movement control order the way it was from March till July, I want to say. Or whether we need to look at alternative ways to figure this out. Are there other models that we could be looking at? Perhaps a targeted one, like the DG suggested, or perhaps a partial scenario. I mean, there's so many things that people are talking about, and I think I'm glad that we definitively will know on Monday, because all of these rumors and WhatsApps swirling isn't really helping people feel safer, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I also want to point out that the reason why we wanted to talk about the amount of different countries and states that are going in and out of lockdown is to say that this seems to be a pattern, right? Mm-hmm. That keeps recurring, whether it's because whether it's because visitors are welcomed back into the country, whether it's because of imported cases, whether it's just because when lockdowns are lifted, everybody does go out there and, wants so badly for things to be back to normal. I'm not certain. But the point is that lockdowns have been proven, at least in the short term, they work, right? The cases always drop. We do see some measure of control return. But following on from that, in the longer term, it's so disheartening, I think, to be almost exactly back where we were a year ago, having gone through all these cycles. So I think my question is, yes, movement control order, okay. What other things need to be happening in tandem with that? What else do we need to be considering as actions outside of playing around with this idea of controlling movement? So that's something that we'll get into right after this, but also just let us know what you think, right? If we do return to an MCO, do you think that will help? Is that a good move? Are you somebody who runs a business? How will that impact you? Share your thoughts and questions with us. That number to call is 7732900. WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. We're now crossing over to health systems and policy specialist, Dr. Kaur Swee King. Swee King, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Lynn and Sharmila. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, just simply put, do you think we need another MCO, and why would it be beneficial or otherwise at this point in time?
That's an exceedingly difficult question to answer, requiring much information that probably needs to be disclosed by the government. Whether or not we need a lockdown depends on variables such as what is the projected number of cases in the coming few weeks? Number two, what is the total testing that we have done and the percentage of positive tests total tests. Number three, we want to look at the utilization rates of the healthcare facilities and the low-risk quarantine centers around Malaysia as well. So without a clear and definitive data, which the health ministry could share with the government and also the government sharing with the population of Malaysia, it's very difficult to say whether or not we need a second lockdown.
So the DG did recently say that in order to manage our current situation, we might need to implement what he called a circuit breaker, and then he went on to describe a more targeted approach. What do you think we can expect from these sorts of measures?
There would be, let's go back 1 year, if I may, to answer this question. The terms could change. We could call it a lockdown, movement control order, movement restriction, circuit breaker. But the general principles of restricting movements remain the same. So to go back 1 year ago, is for us to understand from a public health perspective, we want to have fewer human interactions so that the virus doesn't jump from one person to another. Can we do that in a way that maintains the economy, maintains certain amounts of public life, and maintains our mental health, and as well as national, shall we say, the important public life and societal elements, which we're very, very used to? So to consider a lockdown by any means, yeah, is to consider three factors. Number one, how geographically, how widespread is the lockdown? So I'm talking about space. Number two, how long the duration of the lockdown will be. So I'm talking about time. And number three, the severity of the lockdown, the intensity of the restrictions that you're putting in place. For example, completely no movement out of the home, or some amount of inter-district or some amount of intra-district travel is allowed. So the point we're making here when you're talking about space and time and intensity will help you guide the national conversation about whether or not we actually need a lockdown. And to go a little bit further ahead in time, is to say that we've had a lockdown, a full MCO for about 2 months between March to May last year, and it did bring the numbers down at some cost, or some would say great cost, to the economy. The next question would be, what do we do with the time that we have earned after we've gone through the national sacrifice of a lockdown? It can work, and of course it can work, right? Nobody disputes that. But the question is, does it work at what cost, and what do you do with the time that you can buy as a result of the lockdown? I think those are equally important questions to answer in a 2-3 year pandemic scenario that we don't have an easy escape from. We can't just lurch from lockdown to lockdown. We really have to see what are the results of the lockdown and how do we spend the time that we earn as a result of the national sacrifice.
So I do want to talk about the fact that perhaps because of the reluctance to go back to March 2020 and a full MCO, there are these conversations about perhaps implementing restrictions in stages, perhaps, you know, having different rules for different spaces, and so on and so forth. Do you think that having this amount of variety would be helpful? Would it be confusing? How do you think it can play out?
It will be helpful in principle. It can be confusing, but that can be mitigated in two ways. Firstly, communication, as in you actively and clearly communicate out to the public, and you make it very predictable. So, for example, many countries have got a traffic light system, green, yellow, amber, red, and so on. Or they might have tier 1, 2, 3, 4. It's very easy for people to understand that because it's very predictable if it's in a cycle from one tier to another or one color code to another. So communication and predictability will help make it less confusing for people. That's the second part of your question. Allow me to return to the first part. And the first part would be, would it be more helpful for us to have more nuanced, say, restrictions and more refined restrictions? So let me invent an example. We can use an epidemiological burden in a red district or a red zone district. In the education sector, you have a requirement ABC. In the social sector, you have requirements DEF, for example. And if you're a green zone or a yellow zone, for example, then you have different requirements regarding the epidemiological burden of your particular district at that time. After 1 year, we probably can use a lot more nuance. In the beginning, we can use a blunt instrument. MCO everywhere around Malaysia, one size fits all, that works because we're understanding the virus and we're figuring out what to do. But after a year, a more refined approach as advocated recently by the DG of Health and the apparatus of the Health Ministry is probably the right way to go. Our societies today in 2021 is far more sophisticated and complex than the smaller, simpler societies of the 1960s. And it's, I would even say that the one-size-fits-all blunt instrument that we utilized in the first month of the pandemic is no longer fit for purpose in the second year of the pandemic.
So I do have a follow-up here, in the sense that I think we are seeing lots of conversations and a lot of observations, in fact, that even now, with the SOPs being reiterated over and over again, there seems to still be confusion about guidelines. And so my concern here is that if we were to hope for a more nuanced, a more, as you say, refined version of the MCO, that communication is going to be so important. How do you think that can best be done?
It can be done in a few ways. The first one is, it's a bit, say, straightforward, but the challenges are in the execution, implementation, of course. So I'll sketch out the principles for you. After a year, we really should get the inter-government agency, inter-agency, inter-ministerial coordination down pat. So we really should have been able to do this very, very well. So when you issue one set of guidelines, can ministries don't... which they clash with one another and you're well coordinated, that will reduce confusion. This is number one. Number two, guidelines and SOPs should not change so quickly. What I mean to say is they should be very predictable. Again, in the first few months of the pandemic, it's very understandable that we'll have some confusion. But in the second year of the pandemic, they shouldn't change so much. They should really be more predictable, more stable, more resistant to change and less likely to change. And when it doesn't change, when it's predictable, and you don't have, say, policy U-turns and so on, then citizens will find it easier to understand as well. That's the first two. And the third one is simplification. Often, a lot of the SOPs are repetitive. Repetitive in the sense that they'll always tell you physical distancing of 1 meter, wear your face mask, and check in with mice, etc. And all that is helpful. How can we simplify that, for example, into the top three things, like the 3 C's and the 3 W, that we want to educate people, and we start hammering on those messages. And everything else, even though it's refined, we can always rely on a core set of public health messages that people can understand. So to summarize, how can we reduce confusion? Number one, inter-agency coordination. Number two, more predictability, fewer changes. And this is the conscious effort. Number three, simplifying it by reducing everything to a core that people can understand. And then you have one or two variables according to the sector that you're thinking about.
So the DG is aiming for a policy where the impact is high, but the cost remains reasonable and still comes out with a good outcome. How would you quantify each of these metrics?
A great monitoring and evaluation question. And monitoring and evaluation, or M&E, is a branch of public policy that seeks to understand how the policies were implemented. So formulating the policy, anybody can say can formulate one and write an SOP. But how do you monitor and evaluate the effectiveness of it? So M&E, monitoring and evaluation, is a branch of science that is fascinating, and people can Google up and read more about this. So in practical terms, to answer your question about M&E, it can be done in a few ways. The first one is to run simple surveys, and we understand simple surveys, and that this will help us gauge the effectiveness of the policy in question. Number two, to understand the cost of it requires us to build a model for which we can input things like the time cost, administrative cost, and the financial cost of a particular policy, and then you match that with the impact of the policy, impact in the sense of you agree on a metric, and every metric will be imperfect. We can say metric of if you apply this consistently in District A, you will see a reduction in cases 10 to 14 days later. And that is one metric that you can tie to a cost by creating a model out of it. I mean, this is getting a little bit more technical, but these are the two ways that you can judge the monitor and evaluate the effectiveness of a policy as opposed to the cost involved in creating the policy and implementing it.
Now, to move a little away from just the health aspect, I mean, the hope with all of this, of course, is to not sacrifice the economy for public health, or vice versa, to not let go of public health because we're focused on the economy. But is this a realistic expectation to have?
Not only is it, yes, it's a realistic expectation to answer the question directly. Is it easily achievable? No. Is it difficult? Yes. But is it realistic? Yes. Not only is it realistic, it's probably necessary, as in our entire existence as a country depends on us finding that balance between lives and livelihoods and giving it a really good goal to find that balance between lives and livelihoods in the next 2 to 3 years of this particular pandemic. So not only is it realistic, it's probably very necessary, and our survival depends on us finding that balance. Let me explain why in a few ways. If we lock down, people might say have adverse health effects as a result of poverty, mental health challenges, rise in suicide cases, domestic violence, and so on. So these have been documented as a result of the first MCO and the subsequent versions and iterations of it. But on the other hand, if you don't restrict movement, then you could be seeing a rise in cases of COVID, and subsequently, if hospitals are swamped, then if you have a heart attack or if you have a stroke or any medical emergency and you go to the emergency department, your healthcare will also be compromised. Those are the reasons why we have to strike that balance, and there really are no two ways about it.
So in closing then, beyond an MCO or a circuit breaker or, you know, whatever phrase we're choosing to use to describe this, what other options would you like to see explored to manage the situation?
In recent days, there have been some documents sent out by various groups and parties that detail specific suggestions. For example, an open letter to the Prime Minister that was sent just yesterday. And in it are 10, what I think are 10 great suggestions, which could be food for thought for the rest of Malaysia as well. There are no, shall we say, magic solutions. So I would hope for the following. Movement restrictions should be used as a last resort policy tool, not a blunt force instrument that we use in the first instance every time we think that the case numbers are going to be higher. That's one. Number two, testing needs to be done better in the sense of integrating RTK or rapid test kits with the longer but more accurate PCR or polymerase chain reaction test. What we can do is also to bring our contact tracing from the analog age into the digital age by truly integrating data with MySejahtera and then integrating MySejahtera with the applications, state applications like Sri Lanka and the Penang application and the Sarawak application as well. And isolation, meaning DJ Hisham has previously stated that we might consider putting a Category 1 or Stage 1 or Stage 2 patients to be isolated at home instead of putting them into low-risk quarantine centres. This deserves a bit more study, and in many other countries appears to be the default standard as well. So that will mark a departure from Malaysia, but it's probably a good move as well to isolate say, asymptomatic COVID patients, not in low-risk centres or hospitals, but at home with clearly defined SOP so that they don't infect their household, and as well as instructions of when to seek medical attention. So I've just given you 5 examples of a suite of solutions. There are really no magic solutions to this. The vaccine, we've got great news today from the NPRA. The vaccine will help, but deployment will take 18, 24 months or so. So ultimately, we have to rely on a suite of tools for the next 1 to 2 years for us to be truly safe.
Sui King, thank you so much for speaking with us this evening.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Kor Sui King, Health Systems and Policy Specialist, talking to us about the possibility of us going back into a targeted approach of the movement control order. You have been sharing your thoughts. Keep them coming. We'll be back to revisit them after the 7:30 news. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9, the business station.